Welcome to the Clinical Pre-Hospital Care Research Forum Journal Club. Here in our PCRF Journal Club, we promote evidence-based practices by critically evaluating the latest science in emergency medical services. We hope our discussion will help advance EMS practice. Through the generous support of our sponsors, Limmer Education and ESO, we are able to make science more accessible and understandable.
All right, welcome everyone to the March 2025 edition of the Pre-Hospital Care Research Forum Journal Club. Special thank you again to our sponsors, Limmer Education and ESO, for making it possible for us to be here together today. I'm Rimley Crow, and today I am joined by Tony Fernandez, Jeff Rollman, Michael Caduce, and Bill Toome. And we are very fortunate, excited, over the moon to have with us from the authorship team of the paper that we'll be reviewing. We have with us the primary author and research associate, Jane Hughes, as well as Professor Fiona Sampson. So welcome to our authors. Thank you again for joining us. And as a reminder for those at home, the name of the article that we are reviewing today is Would Provision of Take-Home Naloxone Kits by Emergency Medical Services Be Perceived as Acceptable to People at Risk of Opioid Overdose? A Qualitative Study. And this is hot off the press in pre-hospital emergency care. This article, as always, is going to be paired with a column written by our very own Michael Caduce in EMS World called Journal Watch. I encourage all of you listening to check out these articles. They are found at emsworld.com under the category of education and training. And to those of you who are here live with us today in the audience, thank you for joining. And as a reminder, you can use the chat in the Q&A feature as we go to bring in questions and comments, and we will bring those into the discussion. So without further ado, let's kick this thing off. First of all, I think it would be helpful for our audience if we get a quick introduction from our authors. Perhaps you can tell us who you are, what you do, and I'm always curious to hear how you got interested in research and in general, EMS research. So Jane, let's start with you.
Thank you. Hi, so my name's Jane Hughes, and I'm a research associate at the University of Sheffield, which for those of you who don't know, England is in the middle to the north of England. So we are not anywhere near London, which we just have to make that clear, because I feel like most Americans know where that is. We're a little bit colder, we're a little bit hillier, and we're further north. So just to put that in context. So yeah, so I'm a researcher at the University of Sheffield, and I'm in the healthcare research unit. So primarily, I obviously do research into different healthcare topics. I have worked in addiction for quite a while. So before the study looking at naloxone provision and opiate issues, I did work in addiction research for alcohol for about 5 years. So I'm quite experienced at talking to people in addiction and looking at sort of healthcare issues generally. My path then, I did a master's at the University of Sheffield as a mature student when I was about 45. So quite late to the game. But before that, I was a trained primary teacher, and I actually started working in educational research and wrote a paper. And I then became interested more in the healthcare side following a cancer diagnosis and treatment. So I decided to transfer my master's from education at the university into healthcare research. And since then, I've worked in the area for about 15 years now. And I really enjoy it. It's so fascinating.
Well, thank you for being here. And what a fabulous journey. So many of us don't have a straight path into EMS. And I myself am also one of the ones I would consider myself a mature entry into EMS, having had a different life and a different career in business before EMS. So really exciting and interesting. And Fiona, would you mind giving us an introduction?
Certainly will. Yes, so I'm Fiona Sampson. I'm a professor of health service research, again, here at the University of Sheffield, which I would state is in the north of England, but geographically very close to London, but otherwise not. I've worked worryingly close to 30 years in health service research now. I started off doing health economics modeling, and then moved using the sort of mathematical side of my background, and then moved into qualitative work, wider health service research. And over the years, I've just due to mainly due to the people I work with, there's a bunch of emergency department consultants. We've worked on various projects, largely looking at how health services are organised, focusing on ED and pre-hospital care. And recently, I've been working a lot of projects looking at the sort of the interaction between ED and pre-hospital care. Yeah, I got into this study with Jane and a team of people who work down at Swansea University. But yes, recently I've been doing a lot of pre-hospital work, and we work really closely with our local ambulance service, Yorkshire Ambulance Service. And it's yeah, really interesting. And it's like I say, it's a burgeoning topic, well, area. Pre-hospital research has just completely taken off over the last few years, and it's really good to see.
It is really good to see, and it's exciting as well. And I certainly appreciate the geography. I'm going to have to definitely pull up England and make sure. I didn't know there's such a competition. I'm here
Oh, yes. Oh,
for it. Beautiful thing. Well, let's dive into this study a little bit. I know folks are very interested in this topic. And so, Jane, I'll start with you. Perhaps you can tell us a little bit about the objective of the study and what made you decide to take this topic on.
okay, so am I okay to explain the wider study? Because this is a component of the wider
I
study.
think that would be very helpful.
Lovely. So the wider study is called the TIME study. And that was basically looking at the feasibility of carrying out a full-scale RCT, randomly controlled trial, into naloxone provision within emergency medical services, and that's the emergency department as well. And something that we do a lot in the UK and England is we always pair a RCT with some qualitative work as well. That is almost always the case now. And that wider study had obviously looking at a, I think we had four geographical trust sites. And so the idea was two of them, they would then have this naloxone provision from ambulance staff and from emergency department. I think it was over 1 year, 12 months. And then the two matched sites, they didn't provide any naloxone. And the idea was to look at how feasible it might be to provide naloxone through services. So they were really looking at things like the cost of doing it, staff time, staff beliefs, lots of components. And also, I think in the end, they were looking at mortality rates. So, in other words, in the sites where they provided the more naloxone, was there a drop in mortality or any changes that could be explained by the provision of naloxone against the sites where they didn't? And quite importantly, because a lot of patient and public involvement now in the areas of addiction and opiate studies is that we were asked to do some qualitative work, first of all, with health care professionals, which I know Fiona can speak to, but also service users, so people with lived experience of naloxone use and particularly injecting opiates, and also experience of overdose. So our aim really was to look at what experience people had, people who use the services, so that's drug treatment and also ambulance services, what they understood naloxone would do, how what their experiences were, whether they had experienced opiate use, whether they'd ever provided naloxone to maybe a peer or a family member, because we did look for carers as well to research. And I think for us it was really important to do qualitative interviews, very carefully approach service users. So we did spend quite a lot of time working at how to recruit. And in the end, we felt in the UK, we've got very good drug service outpatient provision. And it's a good way for us. We have some good contacts already on some of the trust areas. So we were able to go in and talk to clinicians and staff and get them on board with us and get them to help us with the recruitment. We've already mentioned ethics. It is sometimes quite challenging to get ethics approval to go in and talk to people. But again, because we have clinicians on side, we were able to do that.
Yes, I love that this is situated in the larger study, and maybe
Yeah.
we can hear some at the end sneak peek on how that's going. But I would like to invite Tony Fernandez to join us so that we can dig into some of the methods. And Jane, you hit on a lot of really important topics there. I want to make sure that we revisit some of those, but I'm trying not to steal Tony's thunder about study setting and design. So, Tony, I'll turn it over to you, and then I'll probably come back with more questions.
Yeah, absolutely. And I want to thank our authors again for joining us today. I think this is a really exciting study to talk about, and I really appreciate you giving us some of your time today. So let's dive right in. You did mention some about the recruitment, and there's a lot of folks on this call who are just getting into research, and recruitment is certainly one of the most important parts of your study and can be really difficult. Can you dive a little deeper into how you recruited these folks, or how you identified them and actually got their buy-in to participate?
Yeah, so I think one of the things that's, I'm not sure what the American setup is, but what's important for us is we always have a lot of patient and public involvement. So right from the start of applying for funding to do some of these big research projects is that you engage with service user groups. So it might be a drug users forum, something like that. So they are people with lived experience who are keen to give their input into research studies. So a really useful thing is if you can connect with one of those groups, you can ask those people, what does this research look like to you? What would you want from this? What do you see the problems? If we just go in and start talking to people, can you tell us what you think the barriers would be and how we can work with people on the front lines to reduce the barriers? And, it's sort of woven all the way through our research. So throughout the study, we have a really good group in Sheffield and we go back to them and they are people with lived experience and we talk about what's happening. If we have a problem with research, we go back to them and ask them how they'd approach it. Do they have any other tips? So that side of things, if you can, and I don't know what the American setup is. Again, it's really useful to have that on the ground. If you can connect with somebody, maybe in a local site that knows other people or is somehow connected to a group of people with lived experience, one or two people can then gateway you to some of the other people in terms of recruiting.
Yeah, absolutely. Leveraging the experts and having some collaboration it is worth its weight in gold. And we're talking about research for sure. So let's talk about how you included these folks. So you were looking for individuals who were 18 years or older, right? Who we talked about had some experience with opioid use. But what was really interesting here was one of the things that you wanted also for these folks were that their caregivers or their family members or partners could also participate. Can you talk to us about why that was so important for this study?
Yeah, I think it's because we were quite wide in our remit. We wanted to know what people's experiences were, but we also wanted people to say how they would use, if you had a kit in the 10-minute training, what would you like to see? And we knew from the literature that people have family members, they're in peer groups, they often perhaps experience opiate use together, and a lot of them had seen other people overdosing. And they told us all the way through it was important to have access to naloxone so that they could rescue other people or they could be rescued. And carers and people, maybe family members, was quite important. So we felt like we wanted to talk to carers and family members. Now, in the end, it was one of our sort of shortcomings, if you like, is that we only managed to recruit one person. And I do refer to that as a carer. But technically, they were an ex-opiate user as well. So I felt like we could sort of describe them either way. It was more difficult. And I think that's because when I went into drug services, I can't approach a patient. The clinician or the healthcare professional will talk to them and say, there's a researcher here. This is what they're trying to achieve. Would you be interested in talking and doing an interview? And we did find that people with lived experience were happy to do it, but we didn't get anybody else. And maybe it was just because maybe most people were visiting and outpatients on their own, so they didn't have anybody else with them. And we weren't able within this study to recruit any other way. So for us, we just couldn't approach people. We just had to see if maybe somebody came with an involved family member, supporter, carer. So yeah, we did fail on in terms of recruiting carers.
I think it was an important consideration, and it just speaks to how rigorous some of this research is, just in the recruitment phase and throughout the study. We'll dive into some of the rigor that you put into some of this qualitative information gathering. So we talk about used a semi-structured interview guide that you developed from the literature, and this is one of the most important pieces of the work, right? Because you have to be able to tease out the right information from your participants. And just going through that literature and developing this guide, can you talk to us about some of the work that surrounded that, and how you were able to actually decide on the questions that you would ask these folks in the limited amount of time you had with them?
Yeah, so I think one of the important things is this was written quite early on in the research study. And again, just thinking about this qualitative piece of work is situated within the larger study. And that's one of the things about healthcare research. Usually it's quite specific. So again, thinking about this wider study, the TIME study, a feasibility RCT, they wanted certain key information. So in terms of feasibility, really specific about what's going to help, what people's experiences are. So in a way, because it's semi-structured, it means it isn't a sort of why don't tell me everything about your experiences and what you know. We had to be quite specific. So there's lots of opportunity for people to share, and we are very open to whatever people say. But also, again, having a semi-structured topic guide means that we can really make sure that we cover all the areas. So, for example, this study is about emergency medical service, so ambulance or paramedic staff that go out. But we also needed to ask about specifically people's experiences in the emergency department. So we had to make sure that we covered that as well. So I guess for us, it was just looking at the literature and then looking at the needs of the wider study and then working out what questions were really important, but also within that, teasing out all the sort of minor points because we kind of wanted to know about health beliefs. And that isn't quite as straightforward as give me your experience, you know. We were trying to, and also we ordered them in a certain way. So we start out quite generally. So kind of relax people, get them to have a bit of confidence because you've got to build up a relationship really quickly over, say, a 20, 30-minute interview with that person. You need to put them at ease. You don't want to start prying and bear in mind this is about ex difficult experiences of opioid overdose. And so we've got to be really sensitive and really careful. So we certainly have ways that we will, you know, if, say, for example, obviously I did the interviews. If people are, if I can sense that people are finding it difficult or, you know, I feel like we need, I will stop, I will offer to end the interview there and then. I will say, this appears to be difficult for you. I always have water tissues, you know, all those practical things. But I think when you're doing qualitative interviews, you've got to be really careful and think about the other person's experiences. And again, in addiction, I think it's particularly important. So it's a balance, isn't it? It's planning, but also we also acknowledge that maybe we are missing something in our questions. So again, if we're as open as possible and check understanding and check, is there anything else that we need to know? I think that gives us even more information.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'd imagine being flexible and kind of reading the room, so to speak, in
Yes.
these interviews
Yeah.
is really important. Dr. Sampson, I'd love to hear from you on some of your experiences in recruiting these folks as well, and developing this structured interview guide.
Yeah, I just wanted to add to basically what Jane said. So there are a couple of things. One around the recruitment. So Jane mentioned that we had the staff at these centres were they were basically the gatekeepers to these patients. So we couldn't well to these people. We couldn't recruit them directly, and that did make it more difficult. There was also the timing of when this happened. So in another kind of world, we might have gone back and thought, right, okay, we really need to specifically target these carers and go back into the centres. But COVID hit, and so this was the time when the kind of practicalities were just we just had to say, you know, we can't do any more here. We can't physically go in and try and recruit these people. But you know, lessons for future is kind of if you're not getting the people you need to start thinking about the recruitment participant other recruitment practices and maybe some snowball sampling or something to try and kind of get a carer and get someone else who could help. And in terms of what Jane was saying about how the interviews were conducted, so I know there were kind of we had some issues when we went back and looked at the data, and we found that one of the questions we wanted to know is what's your perspective on them offering this in emergency departments? And this was at the end of our interview schedule, and we actually found when we came to, you know, when we got the first batch of interviews, and of course it takes time, they go off and they're transcribed, and then you come back and you start analysing them, and you realise, oh, we've got quite a hole here. And we found that they just weren't getting, we weren't getting to this stage of the interview schedule because they'd lost concentration, they were tired, and Jane was having to kind of wrap up because she realized it was not ethical to carry on with these conversations. So we ended up changing the interview schedule sort of towards the end so that for the last few interviews we put that question at the front so that we could get some more information. So it's quite yeah, we had to be kind of flexible in how we actually undertook the interviews so that we could try and fill those gaps that we realized we'd got, mainly, you know, like Jane said, due to the you know, due to the population we were speaking to. And I know that you said, Jane, didn't you, that, you know, some of the people they were having kind of dressings done at the same time. It wasn't an ideal interview situation where you kind of have an hour and you'd be sitting somewhere nice and comfortable,
No,
and
I mean,
it was very pragmatic.
some people were in very active withdrawal, and they wanted to do the interview. I mean, a couple of people kind of fell asleep on me. So, and I think that's quite well, actually, I mean, just to explain our technique, because we were sort of we'll probably talk about how we did the data analysis and the iterative process. But I think the advantage for us is because we three of us analysed a small section of interviews, we realised quite quickly before more are being conducted, we're not getting the information about emergency department experiences. So then we were able to adapt, get the next round of interviews where we really focused on that. And I think maybe that's another tip, isn't it? You've got to be quite flexible, and I guess you've got to. It's actually very useful to analyse as you go. And we had written that into our process anyway, which is lucky, really.
Yeah, and you transcribed the entire interviews word for word, which I'm sure was very useful as you went back and you kind of teed this up for me. As if we planned this ahead of time, and we didn't. But I appreciate it. When we're talking about doing your coding and identifying your major themes, that is not trivial work. That is the in-depth work to get in there and really understand the information that you've gathered. Can you talk to us a little bit about that process and how you actually went in and took out this really important information from the interviews that you conducted?
Yeah, so as I sort of mentioned the paper, but we did a constant comparative process. So we actually did, we looked at three initial transcripts. Three of us did that. So we have another colleague, Jackie, who also did the coding. We did it all separately using the same transcript, and then we all got together and discussed and looked at how we had coded it. And so there wasn't any bias because we'd all done it separately and didn't talk about it. We were all looking at the same transcripts. We then worked out what we thought the initial coding framework would be. We then looked at another section of transcripts, did lots more coding. At that point, you can see what's happening, whether there's any differences, whether there's convergence, divergence. And that gives you a really good idea that what you've got is quite good coding in terms of it being very different people's coding all kind of meshed together, and there weren't any massive key difference. You know, we weren't looking at a piece of writing and saying completely different things. We had a very high level of agreement. But again, because of that process, we all noticed that, oh, there's very little about the emergency department. People just didn't tell us. They either didn't have it, and what we discovered was, having done another batch of interviews, it wasn't that people didn't want to comment. They did not have the experience of the emergency department. Most of them just didn't go there, so they just couldn't speak to it at all. And it's not something that we predicted, actually. It's just in real life, that was the actual case. That was, we just didn't, they didn't have the information to give us. So they didn't really have an opinion specifically on that area.
How interesting. And I would have loved to have been a fly on the wall during your meetings where you came together to
You
talk
have
about
to
those
do more
transcripts.
interviews.
I bet you that was that was a lot of fun. So I have the task of holding us up from our results to talk about these methods. But before we get to the really interesting results, I'd like to open it up to some of our other panelists to see if they have any methods related questions.
I'll get us started with one. I'm curious about, since we are talking about an international system, and some of us might not be familiar with how regulations are in the UK. So perhaps you can talk to us a little bit about what a typical take-home naloxone kit is like in the UK. And here in the US, we just recently had where naloxone became something that I can purchase over the counter at a pharmacy. I'm curious about the regulation on this in the UK. Do I need a prescription? Can I buy it at any store? So perhaps you could just give us a little lay of the land.
I will do. Fiona, please feel free to chip in. She might know more about it. But in this study, they were looking at a naloxone kit, and it's a small yellow box. It's got a syringe with five doses in it, and then there's a leaflet with it. So the idea was it's a quick 5 to 10 minutes training from a medical professional in this study. So just to talk about the study initially. And then obviously people can take one kit away. But what we discovered and what is fairly standard is we have a lot of drug support services in the UK, and they give out a lot of kits by the looks of it, because what people told us was, yes, I used to live in this area of the country. I've got a kit from there. I've got a kit from my drug services now, or even a sort of third sector, as we call it, a charity support, you might get a kit as well. It did seem like there wasn't really a sort of fixed way. It just people were giving them. Obviously, they don't cost anything. Fiona, do you know if anybody else provides the kits?
So a lot of kits are there, like you say, they're provided in the community. They're free at the point of delivery, so they're not. I know some of the different systems that were set up across the US. Some of them have been via prescription, which obviously leads to lower translation. But no, the actual kits are delivered. And one of the issues with the feasibility of the study was actually it would be very difficult. So this was a feasibility study for a larger RCT, was we found that it'd be very difficult to understand which kits had been allocated in emergency care as opposed to just generally kits that people had. So when they were trying to recruit people in the emergency department, in the ambulance service, people were saying, well, I've already got a kit. And then some people might have more than one. So actually being able to attribute the kit to the ED or pre-hospital care was very difficult. It's like I say, like Jane said, it's free at the care point of delivery. I think it was funded. I think there was specific funding for this trial. But certainly community centres and pharmacies can allocate kits. And I think there's generally a recognition that the more people that come, the better. But there certainly isn't a prescription that you then have to convert into a kit.
Important context, and I'm definitely in agreement with the more the better. And it's nice here to see some of those barriers going away as well. Jeff.
Thank you for that context, and thank you so much for sharing your study today and joining us. I know it's much
Oh,
later where you are, so appreciate you sharing the amazing work that you're doing in the UK, and also sharing even things like the supplemental file where you included your interview guide. So folks here in the US were thinking, hey, I want to replicate that here. What questions should I ask? You already provided it. So really nice of you to do that. Also had some questions about sort of the policy context Dr. Crowe already addressed as far as the accessibility, but was wondering, in the US, we have these wide laws in pretty much every state called Good Samaritan laws, where generally lay providers, untrained non-healthcare practitioners are generally given immunity for providing some care to potential patients in a time of need. And this gives broad protections if they're afraid, oh, I'm going to do CPR the wrong way, I'm going to break bones and I'll get in trouble, or I'll give Narcan the wrong way and they'll get hurt. There's these broad immunity laws. I was wondering if that exists in the UK as well, and if that maybe would affect things if these laws didn't exist.
So is that, sorry, Jane, I'll just come in. Is
No,
that,
great.
do you mean members of the public here?
Yes,
Yeah.
exactly. The people who'd be using the take-home Narcan.
Yeah, the honest answer for me is that I don't know, but I suspect it's not such an issue that the sort of there is generally less of a litigation concern in the UK. I certainly know that I'm sort of bystander P CPR. That's not something that's happened, but I don't know the actual sort of regulations around it. Do you, Jane? Do you know anything?
No, and it's not something that came up in the interview. So we did have several
No.
people who had given naloxone or a peer had given to them, and the concern was around people having going into instant withdrawal, maybe being violent or angry, but nobody mentioned anything to do with whether they, might get into trouble for it, only in terms of police
No.
involvement, maybe if they
Yeah.
had drugs on them. So no, it definitely didn't come up, and I don't know, but I would probably agree with you, Fiona. We don't have the same litigation probably amount
Yeah.
happening. So I don't think it's an issue, actually. I really don't.
No.
I've definitely not heard of it.
No, it
That's
didn't
good to
come up
hear.
with any of the staff either.
No.
And like you say, Jane, like Jane mentioned, some people were concerned, the sort of service users were concerned. There was some sort of worry that the about calling an ambulance because they thought the police might get involved, but actually there's very much a culture of the police do not get involved. It's very much an understanding that that it's about the
Same lives.
patient getting the
Yeah.
care they need at that
Yeah.
stage and not it's not criminalized at that stage.
Definitely a different landscape than in the UK. I passed by a dozen billboards for personal injury attorneys on the way to work this morning. Probably
We're catching up.
don't
We may be catching up with you, Jeff, though,
have
unfortunately.
that. And I was just also wondering, this take-home naloxone, if it was paired with other harm reduction devices, since in the US increasingly we're seeing things like sharps containers or wound care materials or other things that are given aside just from the
I think within the certainly within the outpatient settings. So, I mean, one limitation of this study is that we did only speak to people who were, in contact with drug and outpatient sort of rehabilitation settings. So there, yes, sharps bins, basically everything to try and help people with their recovery or to be safe. So yeah, there's kind of wide programs going on all around the country that I mean we only had a kind of a couple of pilot sites and there were certainly differences there was one in sort of Yorkshire and one in the southwest, which was sort of Bristol. And the services offered there were very different from the information that the particularly the service providers offered. But yeah, there's generally a kind of wide range of different
Needle
opportunities and
exchanges
needle.
as well are quite common, aren't they?
All right, it's the moment we've been waiting for. We're gonna get into the results, and I we'll start off with that a total of 26 interviews were conducted, which included the 18 as mentioned, and then a pivot, understanding that, hey, a lot of these folks haven't had interactions in the emergency department, so we might need to purposefully recruit some experiences there. But that total was 26. And then perhaps we could start with just a high level overview of the themes that you all uncovered, and then we can unpack some specific pieces of that. But Jane, I can start with you if you want to talk just a little bit about the four coding themes that were identified.
Yeah, so we sort of coded into four main themes, and I think we did give a supplement where we broken down all the sub themes. And I think if I just overview them, so many participants had experienced overdose situations, and they knew all about naloxone in kits. You know, a couple of people didn't quite seem to understand what it involved. People found them easy to use. We did discover some concerns around administering to other people, particularly if people then went into sort of, you know, they got angry and they'd lost the hit, and then they perhaps didn't understand they had had an overdose and therefore they didn't know what had happened. But what we really found was that people would still give that naloxone. They, you know, overall, they wanted to save a life. They wanted to help other people. But what we really discovered and was that people really, really want, yes, okay, people do really support EMS provision. We've already mentioned emergency department was a bit trickier. People said, yes, they kind of saw that it would be useful, but that was very much within the context that almost all of the people in the study that we talked to just wanted wider provision. They wanted it further out in the community, and they particularly wanted training, not just for themselves, for peer group, but they wanted it for family and friends that they also could be protected. And I think that was definitely our conclusion, was there's a lot of support for people with lived experience, absolutely want the provision. They're okay with using that kit, and they would use it even if they thought somebody might be violent. They, you know, the overall message really is that, yeah, people don't want to see an overdose. They don't want to experience an overdose. Yes, it happens, but they really valued something that could really help and that possibly could reverse the overdose.
Absolutely. And Fiona, interested in any of your high-level takeaways from these four themes or something else that came out that maybe surprised you or was unexpected?
Well, I was responsible more for the, we did two parts to the study, which was looking at another sort of linked study was looking at the staff perspectives. And that was very interesting, kind of reflecting back on some of what the these participants said about this feeling of, you know, the more the merrier, like I mentioned earlier. And there's very much that kind of, I think that a lot of the concerns that the participants here mentioned were reflected in the staff interview. So things like the kind of fear of aggression, although for the staff obviously they accepted this is part of our role, we have to do it, but particularly, you know, the kind of the more the merrier, the wider the access the better. We were also concerned that there may be some sort of judgment and stigma around these populations, but we didn't particularly encounter that in the people that we spoke to, but we did speak to the positive people, so you know, there's always a kind of bias there. But just looking at the other ones, yeah, the theme two, it was perceived to be an effective and easy to use intervention, very much so. It wasn't, you know, this isn't a complicated intervention, but it is difficult to administer, particularly when patients are kind of, you know, at a certain stage of withdrawal. Yeah, that's my take.
One of the negatives, which we, you know, is that obviously if somebody administers it to a peer, you know, there is that effect with naloxone where they can then drop back into a sort of a semi-conscious because the effect of the naloxone wears off before the effect of the opiate, which is why there's five sort of amounts in that syringe. And, you know, people did say, oh, somebody whacked the whole lot into them, or, you know, so that concern, which I know the healthcare professionals mentioned, and it's certainly something we picked up in the literature, I think that was acknowledged by people that I talked to as well, is that it is a concern, really, you know, because sort of key to administering this, and part of the training was call the paramedics as well, you know, don't just give this yourself and then leave, you know. And yeah, I guess that might be one of the concerns that isn't fully addressed, is that, yeah, you know, really people, we did find evidence that some people didn't then phone the paramedics, they just administered and then that was it. And I know, I think Fiona, that did come up in the healthcare interviews as well. But yes, I think we can't sort of solve all the problems. And yeah, it's something that we did acknowledge, that is an ongoing concern, isn't it? It's kind of important to get some help for people just in case.
Yeah, I think that's a good concern. And I'm glad that you brought up, I was curious when I read that, you know, there's 5 doses in 1 syringe, how often it happens that somebody just gives the whole syringe in the moment. The training was there, but was it accessible in, you know, an emergency situation?
But I guess really, in terms of the people we talk to, they are people who've experienced opiate injection use. So in some ways, they probably are better than, say, if I came across somebody and had basic training, I may panic and probably would give them all 5 doses. But, you know.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that's a key distinction as well. And I will invite the other panelists at any time to come in and ask their questions. I certainly have a lot of them, but I see that Michael has popped on.
Thank you. This is so insightful. I'm really just enjoying the discussion. I know you had mentioned you had one care provider interviewed who also had some experience with this. I sort of think through what I hear from EMS providers, at least here in the US, and I hear a lot of similar concerns. So I thought that was sort of ironic. Did the person on your team who's now the care provider have similar sort of results in their discussion of what they thought based on these themes as well? I'm just thinking they sort of align in my head to what I hear in EMS providers. Just wondering.
Yeah, Fiona, what were the sort of main themes from? I think you've put a link to the results, haven't you, Fiona?
Yes. Just 1 second. What were the link? Sorry, what did you ask for, Jane?
Well, in terms of care providers, so the staff perceptions of, you know, people are getting the kit and then giving all 5 doses or not phoning paramedics. Yeah. I mean, it was something that we saw in the literature as a concern.
Yeah, I mean, that was a concern. That there wasn't much talk about the 5 doses. It was more for the staff, it was more considering how it would work. So whether it worked for, well, there were 2 aspects. So one was looking at whether a trial would be feasible. So not looking at whether provision of take home naloxone is feasible, but whether the actual trial itself would be feasible. So they were kind of talking about you know, whether they'd be able to recruit patients and, you know, whether they'd be able to kind of collect the data that they needed. But also in terms of actually offering the naloxone, that wasn't something that came up within the staff interviews, the sort of concerns about dosage. Some of their concerns are more around whether people would engage with the training and really understand how the training, because especially in the emergency department, was very much a sense that people just wanted to get out because they were, you know, they were coming out of withdrawal and they just wanted to get out and leave as soon as, so that was one of the kind of issues from the emergency department itself, was that actually training people to do this properly was very difficult.
Oh, sure. I can imagine we're doing your discharge information and stuff, but also trying to give you some training. I can see that being very common as well. Very interesting. That was my big question, Romilly, if you've got others on the panel.
Oh, I have so many, but I try not to be selfish, but I will ask the next one. So I think it was, Jane, you mentioned earlier that folks were very agreeable to having wider distribution of naloxone. I'm curious if in any of the interviews, if participants had any suggestions for potentially other locations or methods for distributing naloxone. I know that this study was looking at EMS and ED distribution, but just out of curiosity, were there other suggestions?
Yeah, you know, a lot of them were very keen on something that's quite common in the UK is needle exchange places. So, you know, even if you're not engaging with inter-drug treatment or a third sector charity or anything like that, people use needle exchanges and people visit their doctors, their GPs, for other reasons as well as being somebody who may be an opiate user. So they all said GP practices, you know, because you're there anyway regularly and it's confidential. Needle exchanges and also chemists, because a lot of them may be on scripts for things, prescriptions. And so they might visit the chemist once a week, and maybe if there was a kit there, they could take one. So yeah, actually, it's surprising people came up with really good suggestions, and they were all out there in the community. And yeah, I think we've certainly summarised that up in the paper. Again, it links into that just wider provision, just provide it as much as possible in as many sort of situations so that, you know, people can access the training. Again, I suppose the issue would be, do they just pick the kit up, or is there an actual designated person to do the sort of 5 to 10 minute training? So again, back to that training. I mean, there's quite a good leaflet in with the kit with these needles, so that is fairly straightforward. But I know we were thinking about delivery of this training alongside the kit, and that is because of those issues around, please still ring a paramedic. Don't just administer and then leave it. So yeah, mixed bag, but yeah, put more provision.
I think that's a key point. And I love that you are able to hear it from people with lived experience here in the US. We're experimenting with a lot of ways to increase leave behind naloxone. Just the other day, I got off an airplane and there was one of those old, like where newspapers are stored, and it said free naloxone. So I opened up and lo and behold, there's free naloxone inside.
Wow, that's impressive.
And you know, I also heard from users here, or those who are planning public health programs here, I had the privilege of hearing from Milwaukee County, and one of the things that they were experimenting with is vending machines to access harm reduction resources, because not everyone was able to access this resource, you know, in the 9 to 5 typical business hours. So I think that this kind of an interview is such a great way also to add not just what me, the public health researcher, thinks is a great idea, but hearing it from the person themselves. So
I think they're all amazingly great ideas, actually.
Oh, I'm very excited about this study and its implications for future work. And so I will toss it to Jeff, but I'm curious if this study, have you already seen it have an impact on EMS services, or is there advice and best practices that you're giving to EMS services who may be interested in implementing such a program as Leave Behind Naloxone?
Fiona, you might be able to speak to that.
Yeah, no, it's an interesting question, because part of the issue, so part of the reason this was funded was to try and find out whether the trial would, whether there could be a full trial. And our findings were that actually it was unlikely that a full trial would be feasible, but that's not to say that the intervention itself doesn't work, just that the actual the trial itself wouldn't be feasible for a number of different reasons, partly because the problem sort of recruiting the patients to the study. Certainly the trial itself, I think because of the timing of the trial, there were issues around, again, it was during COVID, so a lot of the staff were sort of burnt out, I guess. They were burnt out with managing COVID, managing, you know, this situation that never happened in their lifetime. So for them, kind of thinking about recruiting was a trial on top of that was very difficult. There were also differences in there was actually a reduction in overdoses at the time as well, partly because actually access to drugs was lower. I think there were issues around the trial around the study that meant that this larger trial wouldn't be feasible. In terms of actually where this is going, I don't know of anything where this has been taken forward in terms of it being used within emergency services. I think the different ambulance services have their own approach anyway. I mean, it's a good question. I would, yeah, I'd like to find out. I think within emergency departments, it certainly we there was less evidence that it might be effective. But because the trial was more inconclusive, I'd say, than anything. So it wasn't that we found that naloxone distributed in emergency settings wouldn't work. It was just that a trial within these settings won't work. And like I say, I think the kind of the timing of the trial was also quite
Yeah,
difficult.
challenging.
Yeah, so one of the links I put in was the actual just trying to find out which
You
one it
got
was.
the protocol.
Yeah, there is a protocol as well, but the whether it's feasible and acceptable is one of the I'm trying to see which one it was. I think it's the second one.
And we'll
Yeah,
make
so
sure
there'll
to
be
put
more
these links in our show notes
indications in.
too. Right.
Right.
Yeah, that'd
Yeah,
be
I think
great.
these are really important studies that go beyond, and it speaks to the importance of this work. And it sounds like, oh, well, the idea of the RCT failed, but how important is this work then to highlight, hey, we didn't invest a ton of time and energy and resources into something that we were going to have recruitment issues, we're going to have data tracking issues, and there's probably a different way to study this. And here, certainly as well, EMS services have their own protocols and their own local practices, and so observational work may come in play there. But I love how this study really highlights that.
Yeah, and I think
Yeah, and
that's the
I
benefit
think,
of qualitative, isn't it, Fiona? I think we actually, this has been presented in different places, but in actual fact, because the fees that didn't work, but we certainly this is quite important that we have managed to get this from the qualitative results in terms of talking to healthcare providers and people with lived experience. So actually, it is the power of qualitative research.
And it's certainly, I mean, that's the issue in research is we've got this sort of hierarchy where you've got your RCT at the top, but certainly that's useful for some things, but it's not everything. And it's absence of evidence isn't evidence of absence. So here, just because the trial won't work doesn't mean to say the intervention won't work. And certainly that, yeah, the study that the feasibility of intervention implementation study that I've put the link to that kind of describes how many people didn't get recruited at the trial and why. And so, we found that it didn't meet progression criteria for a larger study, but it's certainly not an indication of whether the intervention itself works. And one of the main issues around doing a full trial would be just this would be the complexity of trying to understand where the take-home naloxone kits came from, particularly given that there's kind of wider, and if like you say you can pick a naloxone kit out of a box, then how do you know if that one's the one that saved somebody's life or being used is the right one, particularly given that actually saving the kit and registering is not something that is going to be probably in people's minds when they're going through trying to rescue somebody.
Absolutely. Even for a researcher, I don't know if that would be top of my mind. Jeff.
Well, thanks again for this study. I mean, I know you're saying that some of the results you think, you had slightly different thoughts on where it might go, but it's still extremely promising in my mind and what we're able to get out of it. I'm interested in hearing a bit more about the training side. So the takeaways, implications when it comes to training, since we know it's one thing to just get the take-home kits and to have them to hand them out. But as far as the training that's involved, I know there's a lot of different ways that training can be delivered. There's short videos, there's sort of ad hoc training with the chemist, pharmacist, or EMS, or nurse, or physician. But how important do you think training is to actually the use of these in those situations when it's very necessary? And then do you think that training needs to be formalized, or it could be something that when the pharmacist is providing it over, it could be done in a 30, 60 second quick instructions?
Cloud training, I know it was planned in term at the beginning, but I think it was only 5 to 10 minutes. And I believe there's lots of videos and there's lots of links to the video as well of how to do it. And there's the leaflet, but I guess you have to think about people who maybe would struggle with reading, you know, if they
Absolutely.
Can't access. So I guess a video and then somebody talking and showing, you know, does seem to be the best way. But I agree, you know, if all you can do is have the kit in a leaflet, that's got to be better than nothing, hasn't it? So yeah, I guess this trial was training and kit. But practically speaking, what people told us is they just want those kits everywhere. And yeah, you know, maybe the chemist wouldn't have time, maybe the syringe exchange, because also that's confidential. People go in and do it. Maybe they don't want to talk to anybody or be recognized in that way.
Definitely.
Yeah, thank you.
And I have the unpopular task of keeping us on time. I think there's so many more interesting questions we could ask, but I want to make sure, since you have taken the time to be here with us and share your expertise, that you actually get part of the last word. So as part of our concluding remarks, I'd like to offer the opportunity for both of you to share with us, you know, any further thoughts or a key message that you hope EMS clinicians take away from this work, or a sneak peek or hint at something future to come. But I will turn it over and start with you, Jane.
Well, I would just like to say, having had the, you know, very valued opportunity to talk to people at often difficult times for them, and I talked to people who had lost other people and had to watch people not coming out of an opioid overdose, is that people genuinely want to save other people. They actually really value the opportunity. And I know it's there in the paper, but people do not want to suffer from, they are not, it is an accidental thing, and people want help, you know. And I think it's very valued. The maybe people, you know, are in withdrawal and things, and maybe they don't behave like that at the time, but certainly people acknowledge that it's really important, the help, and they valued all the help that they did receive. So that would be my final message, really.
Such an important message. Yeah. And thank you again for sharing this work and your time. And
thank
Fiona,
you for the opportunity.
Yeah. Reiterating what Jane said, to say what really came out of those service user interviews was how valued life was. Mm-hmm. And I think people can be judgmental about this group of patients, you know, and it really came across that actually, you know, people do want to save lives. They want to save their peers' lives. They want their own lives saved.
Yes.
And then on a really boring front, because this is a research project, I think one sort of lesson I'd have is around recruitment. So if something doesn't work, try something else. I keep saying the COVID word, and I'm really sorry to keep banging on about this, but it did restrict our opportunities to kind of go ahead and try different things and maybe follow up where things hadn't worked, whether that was with the staff or with the service users themselves. We certainly would have liked to have kind of gone on and tried to understand the voices that we didn't get as many of, so but we didn't get a chance to. But certainly if you're doing recruitment, be flexible, try more than one approach, and put this in your ethics committee application at the beginning to save time.
Don't think that's a boring message at all. I think that is a really key takeaway, especially for those early in our EMS research careers, that ability to be flexible and pivot when mm-hmm. something didn't go exactly to plan is a really key concept. And so I'm so happy that you brought that.
Okay.
Thank you again to both of you. Really appreciate the work that went into this, especially during a difficult time. I will say the COVID word and keep saying it. I think conducting any research during that time was very challenging, but especially research this important of this quality. So thank you both again.
Thank you.
I do have that unpopular task of bringing us back out of here. So I will give a couple of parting messages, but definitely check out this full article. It is available in the chat and we'll make a link to it in the show notes. It is available free access. It's part of a larger special issue of pre-hospital emergency care focused on substance use disorders. So certainly keep an eye out for all of those articles. And then For those of you who routinely join us, you know the drill, but for those who don't, become routine listeners. We will be back here with the Education Research Podcast later on this month, Friday, March 28th at noon Central. And then we'll be back here with another edition of the Clinical Podcast, second Monday of every month. It'll be April 14th, again at noon Central. And so thanks again to our authors. This is such important work. The nothing about us without us comes to mind from the Institute for Healthcare Improvement. I love that this study really lived that and focused on those who are likely to be affected by an intervention. And to all of you listeners who have typed your questions and comments in the chat, thank you very much for listening. And we look forward to having you here with us next time. So thank you.
We hope you have enjoyed and learned from this PCRF Journal Club. Please share it with other interested EMS professionals. An archive of past journal clubs can be found at pcrfpodcast.org. You can also find us on Facebook at PCRF at UCLA and on our website, prehospitalcare.org. A special thank you to our sponsors, Limmer Education, providing educational tools for success at every stage of your EMS journey, and ESO, dedicated to improving community health and safety through the power of data.